Welcome back, folks. It's Chase and Josh with Factor Fantasy. That's Chase and I'm Josh, and we're here to give you something brand new, never before done here on Factor Fantasy. We announced it last week during the midseason State of the Union. Really excited to bring it to fruition. Started off here today. I'm going to actually turn over to Chase so he can introduce it for it because this is his thing. We talked about it before, something that I was very against, and he broke me down on it. So, Chase, let him know what we're going to be diving into today.
It's the Slay, baby. Let's go. You guys wanted it. You've requested it for the longest time. You've shown what you wanted through the numbers. And so we're giving it to you here today. Hinokami Kagura style, baby. And I'm going to let Jay Nelly kick us off. One hell of a ride. This is the first time we've ever done anime on this show. What do you think about that, Jay Nelly?
Yeah, I was super hesitant to do something like this because then we kind of opened the doors to all sorts of requests for other animes. And, you know, we're just going to kind of do this as a one-time deal. Obviously, if stuff comes down the road that it puts up big numbers, we'll consider it. But this really goes to show that what we do here, we don't do it for ourselves. Because I promise, if it was for me, we wouldn't be doing this. So we're excited to bring this one, though. I will say, I did watch the entirety of the series first just to get a level of understanding about it. It seems like it's going to be a fun one to do. I know Chase is super excited about it. I'm ready to roll with it, too. And just to kind of introduce how it's going to work and how we're going to roll out the episodes and the seasons. Here for season one of Demon Slayer, we're going to be doing three episodes at a time. Each episode's roughly 22 minutes, somewhere around that. So what we're going to do is we're going to give a quick summary recap of each three episodes at a time. For example, here today we're going to be giving a recap of episode one, episode two, and episode three. At the end of each episode, all we're going to do is provide our takeaways. We're going to save the debates and the additional comments for the end. And we're going to kind of keep on with that little sort of sequence. Next week, Chase will take us through, for example, 4, 5, and 6. And then we'll go on and so forth until the end of the season. And then we will compare the seasons to we call it mangas or mangas? How do you say
manga.
It? Yeah. Yeah, we'll compare it to the manga that correlates with the same time frame of what we saw on screen. So really excited to do that, man. What do you think? You want to do a quick cheers before we jump into this one?
Let's do it, man. Malice in the chalice, brother. Cheers,
my man.
Okay, I'll let you kick us off, Jay Nelly.
Yeah, sounds like a plan. So just to kind of go through the recaps, and these are not going to be wildly detailed as we would do for a regular series, so I'm just going to start this one off. The first episode begins, and we meet Tanjiro Kamado and his family, his siblings as well, and kind of to just give you an idea of what who the siblings are, and I ordered them from the oldest to the youngest. We've got Nezuko, Takeo, Hinako, Shigeru, and Rokuda. And it starts off, it's a snowy day, and the Kamado family lives on a mountain. It's a good distance away from the village. And Tanjiro wants his family to have a nice New Year's celebration. So he decides to head to the village and try to sell more charcoal to make a little bit more money. A few of his siblings want to come with him, but because of the snow and the fact that Tanjiro wouldn't be taking the cart, which is usually what he uses to carry the siblings when they get tired of walking, they all end up staying back and they wish Tanjiro luck. And you can tell that his family, all the siblings are super close. There's a lot of love there. From there, Tanjiro makes his way down the mountain and gets to the village. He has a few buyers for his charcoal, and we even get a first look at one of Tanjiro's special abilities. Because a young boy was blamed for breaking a plate, but using his super extraordinary ability to smell, he was able to determine that it was a cat that broke the plate, and the boy was telling the truth the whole time. And that's going to be something that plays into the future episodes of Tanjiro and some of his abilities going forward. From there, Tanjiro had a successful journey. He sold out of all of the charcoal he brought, and he goes ahead back home. But it's starting to get dark outside, and before he begins to climb up, a man named Saburo convinces Tanjiro to stay, and he says that demons come out at night and that he would be eaten if he walked up the mountain at dark. And Tanjiro asks if demons can get in the house. Subaru says yes, but there's a group of hunters called the Demon Slayers who kill demons and keep them safe. So Tanjiro sleeps, spends the night there at Subaru's, and at first light, he heads back up the mountain to go home. About halfway up, he realizes something is wrong, and he says, "Whenever happiness is destroyed, there's always the smell of blood." And he rushes the rest of the way up, and he sees his family, and they're all slaughtered. It's a gruesome scene for an anime, to be honest with you. And you can, and Tanjiro's heartbroken. But I've all the, like, you can see him in weird positions, you know, dead, like open eyes, unseeing eyes. It was pretty cool for like an anime that's so popular to be shown on a platform like Netflix and Crunchyroll. So when you saw the family slaughter there, Chase, what was your first reaction, initial reaction to that?
It was brutal. I think that's one reason this series for an anime has taken off so well, as opposed to so many other animes of the past, is it's really not afraid to show graphics. Not to mention the scene with the snow and when he comes back to the house. It's, that sounds weird to say, but it really is a beautiful scene. It's a gruesome scene, but the animation is really gorgeous here. But it is literally just like Jay Nelly described, an entire massacre. Like, I think that's one thing about this show that's great, is they're not afraid to be graphic and they don't hold anything back, and no one's really safe in this show.
Yeah, and to your point about the animation, that is probably the strongest aspect of this anime. You know, there's a, and like I mentioned earlier, you know, I watched the entirety of the Demon Slayer up until the end of season 3 anyways. Obviously, season 4 just started, so I haven't checked that out just yet. But my biggest takeaway was how far the animation has come along from the days of, you know, from when I grew up with Dragon Ball Z and things of that nature. So, in any event, from here, he realizes that Nezuko is still warm. So he picks her up and he tries to carry her to a doctor for help. And as he's heading towards the village, Nezuko regains a level of consciousness, but not as a human. She is now a demon herself, and she tries to attack Tanjiro. And after a little scuffle, they fall off the side of the cliff, and Nezuko goes to bite Tanjiro, but he forces the axe handle he was holding in her mouth so she can't get to him with her teeth. And out of nowhere, a blue sword flashes, but in the nick of time, Tanjiro rolls away with the sword only cutting his hair versus cutting Nezuko's head off. And the young man wielding the sword is one of the Demon Slayers we heard about earlier. He tells Tanjiro that it's basically hopeless and that Nezuko is gone, and that once someone is turned into a demon, they can never be turned back. And Tanjiro argues back and still begs him to let Nezuko live. The man goes to use his sword on Nezuko, and Tanjiro springs into action. At first he throws a rock straight at the man and it misses, and then he throws another. The young man easily avoids the rocks, and Tanjiro charges him head-on, at which point the young man knocks Tanjiro unconscious, but before he rushed the young man, he didn't see Tanjiro throw the axe at first, and the axe came down within an inch of the young man's face, which would have killed him if the throw was accurate. So this young man realizes how crafty that was, and he respects it. So while Tanjiro is unconscious, Nezuko as a demon now stands over Tanjiro, protecting him and his body, and the young man realizes that these two might be different. And Tanjiro goes into this dreamlike state where he sees his dead siblings, and they tell him to take care of Nezuko. And once Tanjiro regains consciousness, the young man introduces himself as Giyu Tomioka, and he tells Tanjiro to take Nezuko to see a man named Sakonji Irokodaki at Mount Sagiri as soon as possible. He also expresses that he cannot expose Nezuko to sunlight, and then he disappears. Nezuko has been strapped with a piece of bamboo between her teeth so she cannot bite or eat any humans, and before they take their trip, Tanjiro buries his dead siblings, and then him and Nezuko head off to find Irokodaki, and that's where episode 1 ends. So Chase, take me through what you thought in the very first episode of Demon Slayer. Were you hooked just yet? Was it something that you still had to watch a few more episodes? Give me your takeaways for episode 1 here of Demon Slayer.
Yeah, and I think the reason I want to bring this up, this might sound strange to say, but so many people see Nezuko with that thing in her mouth, and it's a piece of bamboo to make sure she's not biting anyone. I remember when I first saw years ago this being advertised, I was like, what the fuck is up with this girl with like a ball gag or something in her mouth? But no, it's a piece of bamboo, and if you watch the show, it actually makes sense on why they do that. But damn, Giyu Tomioka, man, he is a badass. What do you think of Giyu? I know that's your boy, Jay Nelly.
Yeah. As the series had gone on, you know, I did have a few issues with the show and the pacing of certain things, but I really did enjoy the moments that this guy showed up. So as of right now, it's easier for me to call this character my favorite of them up to this point. Obviously, I've not seen episode 4, and I'm sure there's other characters I'll be introduced to that I'll like along the way. But man, I just really liked his stoic nature, the fact he doesn't really say a whole lot, just kind of got down to business, and he still is compassionate enough to make a choice that was against the nature of what he is meant to do, which is kill demons. So yeah, definitely a big Tomioka fan.
Yeah, he is, the way I kind of see Giyu, I think he has a lot of demons built up inside, which I think he's one of those very quiet people that keeps his inner thoughts to himself. But I would not want to meet that motherfucker in a dark alley for sure. So, but the episode one overall, just it really did kind of hook me in a way. Of course, like, it takes a minute for me to really jump in and be addicted to like a series, I would say. But the animation right off the bat with the snow and the whole scene of it being iconic with protecting his sister and the whole massacre right at the beginning. And keep in mind, these episodes are about 20 minutes. So, I mean, that's a hell of a way to start off a series right there. And we're already getting introduced. They introduced characters quick, and you're already seeing some of Tanjiro's abilities here, which is really impressive for how they're just laying the groundwork in the lore here, just even within a 20-minute time frame. But with that, I'll turn it back to you, Jay Nelly.
Yeah, no, my takeaway is it was a good episode. We got introduced to the storyline. We get to see the revenge arc. That's kind of what this entirety of the show is based off of, that and changing a sister back from a demon into a human. And I agree that they laid a good foundation. There are some things I was just a little bit confused about, and I do think that it would, some of the aspects may be a little more, like, for me, enjoyable if they kind of slow rolled it out and we found things out little by little. But, you know, credit to them, this is in 20 minutes. They did do a lot in the 20 minutes, and it was entertaining and definitely something I enjoyed and I liked watching. And you know, it's something as well that even though the plot has kind of been done before of, okay, you know, like, my family's been murdered, gotta kill the guy responsible for it sort of deal, there was some nuances and new aspects that were something that I have not really seen before. You know, this whole, it's almost like a mixture of, you know, vampires, where if you bite a vampire bites you can turn you into a vampire himself, and you know, that kind of sort of deal will play itself out later down the road. But it's almost a mixture of a few things, because then you got the samurai portion, the martial arts portion, the hidden abilities, so there's a lot of fun things that go into it. And again, we only got a taste of it here in episode one, but we're talking about the foundation, the groundwork is laid out pretty well here from the get-go. So yeah, no, I enjoyed it as well, and it wasn't one of those things, you know. For example, I don't know if any of you have a show where you had to get past a few episodes first before you could even try to watch anymore. For me, it was The Office. It was really hard for me to get past like the first 4 or 5 episodes of The Office, because it was just so cringy that I had to like force myself through it. But then after it, I really was hooked into it and really excited to watch the rest of it. This wasn't like that for me. I was interested pretty much right after the first episode. I wouldn't say like I had the moment where, oh man, I can't stop watching this, I'm gonna stay up till 4 in the morning, you know, because I'm so hooked. I wouldn't say it was that level, but definitely kept my interest to the point where I was excited to to continue on and see where it went. And from there, I'll take us into the summary recap of episode 2. Episode 2 starts out with Tanjiro, and he's continuing his journey to find Urukodaki. He stops at a farmer's place and buys a basket and bamboo strips. At first, the farmer tells Tanjiro he can just take it for free, but Tanjiro insists on paying, and out of the basket and bamboo strips that he purchased, Tanjiro makes a carrying pack for Nezuko so that way she can travel during the daytime, because keep in mind, what Tomioka told us last episode is she needs to avoid sunlight. So he goes back to find Nezuko, and she's dug herself a hole in the cave and really trying to avoid any little piece of sunlight. And he gets her to try to go into the new basket he made, but at first she doesn't fit. And one of the abilities that Nezuko had last episode was she was able to grow her own body, like make herself bigger. And so Tanjiro has the idea of, well, if you can make yourself bigger, maybe you can make yourself smaller. And she does have the power to reverse it and ends up making her body smaller and ends up working, and she can now be carried around in that basket. So they set off again to find Urukodaki, and as it turns dark, Tanjiro smells blood. He gets to a house and opens a door, and there's a demon eating the flesh of human victims. Nezuko struggles to resist the temptation of the human blood. You can see her almost salivating through that bamboo muzzle that she had on to prevent her from doing just that and tasting human blood and eating human flesh. While that happens, a demon attacks Tanjiro, and he cuts its neck just a small little bit with the hatchet. It's a very tiny wound, and it heals quickly. The demon knocks Tanjiro to the ground and is about to strike when Nezuko runs over and kicks the demon's head clean off. Dude, I don't know about this one. This one's a little bit funny for me. I don't know how serious I could have taken this part, dude. When you saw her just sprint over and boot his head off his shoulders, what did you think?
I thought it was pretty fucking badass. I wasn't expecting it for sure, especially this girl that's a little girl. And you briefly touched on it for a minute there, but one thing that they kind of mentioned for a second here that plays a big role later on is Nezuko's special ability is, like, in order to get into that basket, she had to shrink herself. Well, now she's grown, like, into this full woman almost when she kicks that head off. But also it kind of showed me how weak this demon is, which I'm assuming will, you know, down the road, I think it's going to be a lot more challenging than what we just encountered here.
Yeah, I agree with you. Actually, that's something that I notated as well, is that this demon is the very base level, must have just turned overnight or something, because it was not very difficult at all based on the other upcoming fights that we see as the series progresses. In any event, even though she kicked the demon's head off, we see that the demons can still function even if the head isn't removed properly. So we got this body and this head separated from each other, but each is able to move on its own. So the body is fighting Nezuko while the head fights Tanjiro. In Tanjiro, we get to see another one of his special abilities. I don't even know if I would call this a special ability, but something that kind of separates him from normal people is that he has a very hard head, and he headbutts the demon. It hurts the demon so badly, he's like, yeah, your head, it's so hard, it's damn hard. Like, it was crazy. But we learn that Tanjiro's headbutts are an effective weapon, and he ends up pinning the demon to the tree with the axe. Like, the demon wrapped its hair around the handle and he launches it into the tree, and it kind of pins the demon there. So then while the demon's head is pinned to the tree, he runs to go help Nezuko against the demon's body. He ends up knocking it off a cliff, and he ends up falling off too while knocking the demon off, but Nezuko catches Tanjiro, and the body of the demon smashes into the ground below, and then the head of the demon back at the tree, that falls limp. So Tanjiro goes back to the tree, and he unsheathes a knife to try and kill the demon, but a hand grabs his shoulder, and there's a man in a mask telling him that the knife isn't going to do the job. So then Tanjiro grabs a rock with the intent to bash the demon over the head repeatedly to crush its skull, but he can't bring himself to do it. And that's when the man in the mask has an internal conversation with himself that Tanjiro isn't going to make it because he's too indecisive and empathetic even to demons. So, as an audience, we can guess that this man is Urukodaki, because he is talking about how he doesn't believe he's going to be able to train this one. But he still hasn't introduced himself yet to Tanjiro. So Tanjiro still can't bring himself to smash the rock over the demon's head, and eventually the sun comes up, burning the demon and disintegrating it. So we now see one of the ways to kill a demon is sunlight, and it only takes a few moments. It doesn't take long, and the demon ends up, you know, burning into ash. So we now realize why Nezuko tries so hard to hide from the sun, why she dug that pit in the cave, why she wants to get in that basket. You know, it only takes a few moments, and she's dust. Afterwards, Tanjiro sees Urokodaki holding a burial for the victims of the demon, and he ends up introducing himself to Tanjiro, saying that Tanjiro is the one that Tomioka sent his way. Urokodaki emphasizes the cosmic importance of never allowing Nezuko to eat a human, says if she does, then Tanjiro will have to kill Nezuko and himself. Urokodaki says he will test Tanjiro to see if he's fit to join the Demon Slayer Corps. So Tanjiro follows Urokodaki to Urokodaki's house, and Urokodaki tells Tanjiro that he will take care of Nezuko, but his first test is to see if Tanjiro can make it back down the mountain to Urokodaki's house before daybreak. So Tanjiro thinks it's going to be an easy task because of his super smelling powers. So he begins the journey down, but he immediately hits a trap, like maybe four steps in, and he realizes it won't be as easy as he thought. And he ends up being able to sniff out the traps, but although he can sniff them out, his lack of athleticism still makes it hard to get past the traps, even though he knows where the traps are going to be. But eventually, he is able to make it back to Urokodaki's house after going through all the convoluted ways of avoiding the traps, getting out of them. You know, he's beat, all bloody, bruised, and battered, but he makes it back to Urokodaki's house before daybreak, and he accomplished the mission. From here, we get a flashback from Urokodaki when he received the letter via Crow from Tomioka explaining his decision to send Tanjiro and Nezuko to Urokodaki. He believes that Tanjiro and Nezuko are different, and that it will all make sense one day. And the scene cuts back to present day, and Urokodaki agrees to train Tanjiro. And he says, "You're now my new student, Tanjiro Kamado." And that's where episode 2 ends. So Chase, take me through your takeaways of this one.
Urokodaki, man, he is awesome. He reminds me of, like, you know, we always make comparisons to this franchise here, but like an Albus Dumbledore kind of guy. And hopefully way in the future, you know, we get to see some action from that guy. But it's interesting because I feel like if you're watching the very beginning for the first time, you don't put a lot of things together that he's saying, but it really is true. Like, if you think about it, like his doubts and considerations here about Tanjiro, about him debating things. And we'll see that a lot later on, as, you know, things are going to get a lot harder. And one slip, one thought, one hesitation can mean the end for what lies out there. And one thing, just like how you're saying, you know, he'll have to kill himself. This is what's really cool, these subtle kind of Easter eggs that the original writer of the books put in there. This actually is original Japanese like lore tradition back in like way like the 1400s or something, but it's called committing Shippuden. So Shippuden. That I'm thinking of Naruto Shippuden. Yeah, seppuku. But yeah, he would have to literally stab and cut his belly and kill Nezuko in front of the Demon Slayer Corps because it's against core rules. So it's I thought it was a great episode. It's really building, but it was one of those building episodes where it really intrigues you and kind of grabs you. Like, how deep can this go now that, and I like the fact that we're about to get into the point where it's not just, you know, in a lot of other franchises, all of a sudden, like, this guy is like just so powerful out of nowhere. And that's what I love about this. It's not that. It's no. His ass is going to have to work hard to get what he wants, you know, and like versus like some other franchises, you know, the main character is just already this super powerful guy. And no, we've seen Tanjiro does have special abilities, but he's going to have to put in some hard work, and he's definitely not exactly what's considered the chosen one right now, for sure. What are your thoughts? What are your takeaways from this episode?
Yeah, you know, he doesn't seem very capable in a lot of ways at this point here as we stand in episode 2. I also agree that the introduction to Uro Kodaki and him being hesitant to even consider taking Tanjiro on as a student is really, it's refreshing, because to be fair, in most works it's something like that. Like Braum in the Aragon series, at first he didn't really want to train Aragon, but then realized he really didn't have much of a choice, and this is sort of the same deal here. But Uro Kodaki does have a choice. He could just say no, but Tomioka, as we saw in that flashback, really explained to him, I think these people are different, I think it's going to make sense one day. And then it really kind of leads you to believe that Tomioka is wise beyond his own years, because he seems more of a younger character in comparison to some of the other ones that we'll meet, you know, later on here at the end of season one. But, you know, I also agree with Chase what he said about the previous episode, that Tomioka has a lot of stuff going on inside his own head that he keeps to himself. And maybe there's some sort of, I don't know if prophecy is the proper word, but obviously, you know, we don't want to say the chosen one, but maybe, you know, there's like this demon's already showing different characteristics and a different nature than most demons. It hasn't attacked a human yet. It's shown that it has the mind to defend the people it cares about. So it kind of leads you to wonder, what is it that they have that Tomioka sees, and why he believes that Tanjiro needs to be trained. I did think that was cool to have Uro Kodaki very skeptical. Like, man, this guy can't make any decisions. He's weak. I don't know if this is going to work. I don't think he's going to make it. And this is him saying before he even really knows him, just off the initial interaction with that weak demon. Because like we were just talking about, that demon is nowhere near a strong, like what I would consider a strong one at all. You know, and if you have issues with this, you're going to be in a world of shit later on. So, you know, I thought it was another good episode. Kept it going on. I was really interested in Uro Kodaki's character. So it was a good introduction to this guy. And I also found it, and I do believe this is going to be a common theme going forward, of how Uro Kodaki took the time out of after the demon was killed by the sunlight to bury the victims of the demon. And we'll see that kind of happens with another character, you know, going forward, not to give anything away for future episodes. But all in all, I did think it was good. It was, and I also thought that, you know, him just starting the training, or at least I would say passing the first test of making it down that mountain, you know, he thought it was going to be easy. He thought, well, you know, I got this crazy sense of smell. I know exactly where I'm going. And he ends up falling into almost every single trap the first way on the way down. But he is able to make it down there. And that's when he gets the approval. Like, you are my new student. And now we're going to see what Uro Kodaki can teach Tanjiro, and how far Tanjiro can go just from his training with this singular individual. So to get through and go back to our very last episode that we'll cover today, episode 3 here in season 1 of Demon Slayer, episode 3 starts out with Tanjiro, and he's checking in on Nezuko, who's still asleep, and her condition's unchanged. Uro Kodaki says, "Let's go," to Tanjiro, and at this part, Uro Kodaki starts narrating and gives a brief backstory about the Demon Slayer Corps. He said a number in the hundreds, and it's not a government-recognized organization. They essentially exist to hunt down demons, but the identity of the Demon Slayer Corps leader has always remained a mystery. He tells us that demons' staple food is humans. They have extraordinary physical abilities. Their wounds heal almost instantly. They have the ability to regenerate severed limbs, and they can only be killed by sunlight or decapitation with a special sword. I want to say that again, because you know, I watched this with subtitles on. He said they can only be killed by sunlight or decapitation with a special sword. Those are two ways. And so I'm going to remember this for later on. Anyways, Uro Kodaki explains that there are many different trainers, and they educate their students using their own methods. In order to become an official member of the Demon Slayer Corps, you have to survive the final selection process on Mount Fujikasani. And Tanjiro decides to start keeping a journal for Nezuko and continues his training. He's stronger. He can pick up scents better. So Urokodaki has been increasing the difficulty. He begins carrying his sword down the mountain. And at first, he again gets caught in almost every trap. But steadily progresses. We learn about the sword's strengths and weaknesses, what causes them to break, and how the direction the blade is facing and the direction you swing it have to be exactly the same. And Urokodaki tells him if he ever breaks his sword that he'll break every bone in Tanjiro's body. Which is funny, that'll be a little bit of a foreshadow, because it might be a time or two where a broken sword comes into play, say that. But I also thought, you know, one of my biggest takeaways right here in the middle of this episode while I'm going through the summary is this Urokodaki's a badass. Like, he trains with Tanjiro unarmed and barehanded while Tanjiro is using a full-fledged steel sword, and he's still whipping Tanjiro's ass. Doesn't even worry about getting hit. Just gets continuously tossed over this dude's shoulder and thrown on the ground. But anyways, from here, he teaches Tanjiro breathing techniques and fighting forms. He tells Tanjiro he will teach him the 10 water breathing forms. And I thought this was a really funny part, too. Tanjiro keeps getting them wrong, but he keeps asking Urokodaki how he's doing. He's like, wrong, terrible, couldn't be worse, awful, bad, still wrong. Like, I thought that shit was so fucking funny. And every time he fucks up, Urokodaki slaps his stomach and just pounds him. Thought that shit was really funny. But any event, at this point, Nezuko has been asleep for 6 months. The doctor came, but couldn't find anything wrong. Tanjiro fears one day he will wake up and she'll be dead. And his mountain training starts getting even harder because he starts at a higher elevation than before, where the air is even thinner. And after his mastery of the new elevation training, Urokodaki tells him that he's taught Tanjiro everything that he can. And when he has this conversation with Tanjiro, he's been on Mount Sigiri for a year to this point. So right here during this conversation, Tanjiro has been training with Urokodaki for 1 year. Urokodaki tells him that the rest is up to Tanjiro himself and that he will have to prove that he is capable of advancing to the next level. He gives him the task of cutting a huge boulder in two and says if he can do it, he will allow Tanjiro to enter the final selection. Now, I just want to explain how this boulder looked. This wasn't just no small rock. This thing was the size of a small damn house almost, and it had a real big thick rope around the circumference of it. And you know, I'm thinking, how the hell is he going to cut a rock in half with a sword? So this is going to be obviously, you know, an issue for him. And I'm thinking, you know, maybe there's other ways to go about it, but we're about to find out what happens. Tanjiro says after that day, that was it. And Urokodaki never taught him anything again. So he started every single day practicing what he learned from Urokodaki. And he followed all the teachings because he wrote down them all in his journal. But even after 6 more months of all that work, he still cannot cut through the boulder. So now he's been on Mount Sigiri for a year and a half. He's about to give up, and he starts headbutting the boulder. And then another boy around Tanjiro's age with red hair and a cat mask comes out of nowhere and essentially tells him that he needs to stop boohooing and that demon slayers suffer in silence. But Tanjiro notices something really peculiar. He notices that the boy has no scent. And that's going to be a little bit of a foreshadow. But the boy attacks him with a wooden sword, and he totally outclasses Tanjiro, makes him look like a complete amateur. He tells Tanjiro that he's already cut through his own boulder, so now Tanjiro at least realizes it's possible. But the boy is disappointed and tells Tanjiro that Tanjiro hasn't learned anything or mastered any of his training, especially not total concentration breathing. He says all that Tanjiro has done is memorize the information, but his body still has no clue what to do. So they continue to spar, and eventually the boy knocks Tanjiro unconscious with barely trying. And at this part here, a small girl walks up, and the boy tells her that he'll leave the rest to her. So when Tanjiro finally wakes up, he's impressed with the boy's abilities, and she ensures him that she'll be able to help Tanjiro be able to do those same things. We learn that her name is Makomo, and the boy's name is Sabito. And Makomo guided Tanjiro and showed him what he was doing wrong. She helped him correct his unnecessary movements and his bad habits, and she constantly told Tanjiro, because every time Tanjiro would ask about their past or anything about them, all she would say is that her and Sabito love Urokodaki very much. And again, I think that's a bit of a foreshadow too. But she explains the physiology of total concentration breathing and how it accelerates blood circulation due to a higher heart rate, which also causes the body's temperature to spike, giving a human the ability to fight with the strength of a demon, and how it's important to expand lung capacity by introducing lots of air into the bloodstream all at once. She tells him that he basically has to train until it about kills him. So he keeps training until he feels like his arms and legs want to fall off. and still Sabito kept beating him. But 6 months later, it finally changed. So now where we are right here, it has been 2 years total since Urokodaki agreed to train Tanjiro. He's been training for 2 years. So to Chase's point about last episode, it's not like this guy all of a sudden just showed up with a sword and was an expert badass after barely touching it. And I'm not going to call out any names, but Rey Skywalker, fucking dueling Kylo Ren to a standstill when she has never been in a fight like that before. Whatever, we're not gonna harp on it. But in any event, again, it's been 2 years since he's been on Mount Sigiri with Urokodaki, and he faced Sabito, and for the first time, Tanjiro's sword fell faster, and he cut the cat mask in half, which was covering Sabito's face. We see Sabito smile, and Makomo tells Tanjiro that he did just great and to keep winning for her. And as they're having this conversation, they disappear in a cloud of fog. And he looks down and realizes that instead of the cat mask, he cut through the boulder at long last. And that's how episode 3 ends. So give me your takeaways, my man. What do you think about episode 3 here?
It was awesome. And one thing I wanted to say, which is really cool, in Japan, they have that actual boulder. So that is my goal one day, is to actually go see the boulder. And it's a split boulder that's actually in Japan that they made. And it's right outside of Universal and Studios where they made the ride. It's not in Universal, but it's a small town outside there where they made it, where they've just really been encapsulated with this series. Where they made the ride and stuff at Universal and everything. So that would be really cool to see one day, but I loved it. I thought it was great, because I really enjoyed seeing the training that Tanjiro has gone through. And you can even see how it's been 2 years, his hair has gotten longer. You can tell he's different than the boy he was climbing up the mountain, running into all the traps. I really enjoyed seeing him, spar with Sabito. And that was a big thing about this series when it first started in 2020. It was very iconic, these cat masks you would see. And I always wondered what that was from. And it wasn't until I watched the series and later on read it that I realized where that was from. And it's the cat masks of Sabito and is it Makomo is her name?
Yeah,
Makomo. So maybe one day I'll just walk around with a cat mask. I feel like that would be an EDC thing. You go to the cat mask to EDC, which they actually did that one time. I think it wasn't EDC, but it was Coachella or something. Whatever one of the big raves is they have in Vegas. They did a Demon Slayer one with the masks, and they played Gurunge by Lisa. So I think that would be awesome. But I thought it was an excellent episode. My biggest thing is, of course, the animation's great, but I enjoyed the writing. I truly did, because I like the progress they were taking with it. They could have just jumped in there and been like, oh, these people are the chosen one. He has this smell and this power. No, you're going to work your ass from the ground up. And also, it's pay attention to every little detail, because every detail you really don't notice in this time, but can play a factor later on. What are your takeaways?
I thought this was a good episode, too. And a lot of it is because it explained exactly how long it took Tanjiro to accumulate these abilities and really get the training to sink in. 2 full years is a long time. And I also want to point out that Nezuko has been asleep for this entire 2 years too, almost in a coma-like state. So, and that's going to come up again later, I'm certain of it. But, that 2 full years is plenty of time if you do something daily to get competent at it, and not just competent, but really good. And so from where Tanjiro started to where he is at the end of episode 3, it's night and day different. And it's still, though, we're going to see he's still got a long, long ways to go. And I'll leave it at that for there. But, it was really great to see it. And I did like the symbolism And, you know, we'll learn more about Sabito and Makomo a little bit later on during season one of Demon Slayer here. But I did really enjoy that the symbolism and, you know, how when he cut the mask was actually the boulder. And he's having these conversations and learning about these people. But when he goes to talk to them after he cuts the boulder and that part of his chain is completed, they disappear into a puff of cloud. And he kind of is wondering if he just imagined the whole thing. And again, that will come up later on. I thought this was really cool. There's a lot of episode three of the ones that we covered so far has been my favorite up until, you know, episode one, two, three. Three has been the one I enjoyed the most so far. So I thought it was really, really cool. It sets the stage for later and how things are going to progress. And now that he's cut the boulder in half, Earl Kodaki told him that if you do this, I'll send you out to Final Selection, and we'll get an idea of what Final Selection looks like next week. And so really excited from there. But yeah, those are my takeaways from that episode. How about Chase, you go ahead and hit us with your debate for the day?
Yeah, man, my debate for the day is like Uro Kodaki. I kind of mentioned before, you know, he's kind of like the Albus Dumbledore of the show. What kind of role do you think he's going to play going forward? Do you think he's going to fade out? Do you think he's still going to be part of it? How much of a badass do you think this guy was? To think about, this guy was a water Hashira even before Giyu. Like, think of the years before. Like, what kind of experience do you think this guy has, and do you think he's going to play a major role going forward or much later on in the series?
You know, kind of starting where we are here from episodes 1, 2, and 3, you know, if you just started Demon Slayer today, you wouldn't really know what a Hashira was, even if you watched the first three episodes. But you'll learn a little bit more about what a Hashira will be if you start watching Demon Slayer a little bit closer towards the end of season 1. But to answer your question about Uro Kodaki, yeah, I think that he's going to play the role of a reoccurring fountain of wisdom, so to speak. Because Tanjiro said himself that Uro Kodaki never taught him anything ever again after he gave him the boulder task. So I think he's just going to come up and with wisdom and maybe help Tanjiro think through certain issues and help him problem solve at random parts throughout the journey. And again, you know, I've not read the full manga, and only up to a couple episodes of season 4 of Demon Slayer out to this point, and I've not seen any of season 4, so I don't really know. But I have seen seasons 1 through 3, and you know, I don't want to just say this as if I'm predicting anything crazy, because I do see what we saw up until the end of season 3. But I do think even that going there and beyond, I do believe that he's going to kind of play that fountain of wisdom and be there to help Tanjiro. And in probably one of those really obscure ways as well, not even giving him the answer directly, but helping Tanjiro think through the problems himself when he does show up again. And then when he does show up periodically, probably like a happy surprise sort of deal. And then when all the shit hits the fan, who knows? Maybe he ends up sacrificing himself at the very end. Because that always seems to be the deal, right? With these older guru type characters, is that they sacrifice themselves for the main character more oftentimes than not. You know, we've seen it in almost every like fantasy fiction piece of work that we've done. You know, in Lord of the Rings, it was Gandalf in the Mines of Moria. In Harry Potter, it was Dumbledore. In Aragorn, it was Braum. Like, so we see it pretty consistently. So even though this isn't technically fantasy fiction, this is anime, I do kind of see that being the role, and maybe the end of his story is that he ends up, we see him in action and we realize exactly how much of a badass he is. And like, maybe in his prime he could have, you know, stood toe-to-toe with the best of the best. But maybe my prediction is that he ends up, you know, sacrificing himself so that Tanjiro can live to see another day sort of deal, and maybe complete the quest that he sets off on at the beginning of the whole series. Those are my thoughts on it. What are yours?
Yeah, those are kind of part of my thoughts too. I mean, it's really captivating thinking about what a badass he probably was back in his day. I would love to see how maybe even in his mind, the training he put Tanjiro through, maybe that was easy training in his mind compared to what he went through and how he got there. And it makes you really think, like, I'm really thinking, like, maybe later on we're going to start to see more into the past of who, like, these powerful people were that laid the foundation for things in the past. Another one, and then I'll flip it over to you for your debates. As far as the demons here, do you think they took the right road by making it demons or the antagonist? For, you know, we have these different fantasy fiction or anime in this case, but still has a fantasy aspect to it. But like the antagonist, for instance, like in Harry Potter, you know, you have werewolves and trolls and evil wizards and stuff like that. Do you think they made the right move by coming up with something unique as far as like it's demons, but it's almost like you said, it's like vampires, or they almost have like a werewolf aspect in a way with how they have special abilities and grow and change and how they face a threat, and they have a unique aspect almost kind of like the vampire in a way, or almost like how we were talking about a couple weeks ago, like the what's the Highlander, like they cut their head off, right? I mean, it's just such a unique aspect to come up with something, and I think in my opinion, I think that's part of the reason too this series set itself apart so much, is just the lore that the writer decided to come up with just out of his own head was such a unique twist to what we've kind of seen before in fantasy fiction. What's your thoughts on that?
I think they did a good job of creating something that isn't the run-of-the-mill, what we always kind of see. You know, you mentioned other fantasy fiction works and the villains that we come across. In Lord of the Rings, it was the orcs. In Aragorn, it was the Urgles. And Harry Potter, like you mentioned, a bunch of magical creatures with like human properties sometimes, like centaurs or, you know, evil wizards. We got the goblins, the trolls, whatever it may be. So this was a bit unique, and I think they did kind of hit the right path of making it interesting, because not only, you know, one of the things we see, especially in the cheesy zombie films, is that they don't really have any special ability more oftentimes than not. Vampires, yes, they can, you know, have superhuman speed, usually superhuman strength or whatever, but typically there's really nothing crazy about it. Where we'll see going forward with these demons, they have actual like blood abilities that they can do that are unique to their specific demon, and it's something that is very I believe it's super unique. So I believe all in all that they'd made the right choice of coming up with this. It was creative. It's something that we don't see too often. And yeah, I mean, even think about if we compare it quickly to another anime in Dragon Ball Z, it's usually the antagonists are just other alien forms that are strong that can use almost the same abilities as the protagonists. It may be a different ways, and maybe the attacks are called something different, but these are very, very different from not only just other works, but even in Demon Slayer itself, you'll see different demons' abilities vary completely from each other. So, I do think it was a really good choice, and it is one of the things that keeps Demon Slayer interesting, and probably one of the reasons why it's the most popular anime right now.
Yeah, I agree, and I just find it so intriguing that, you know, and down the road we'll really get into, you know, what makes these demons so powerful and you know, really like how in depth like everything goes as far as like who's more powerful than who and how you get there and just like how we even touched on today full circle, like the training and stuff that's involved. So I think so too. I think it's very unique. I think they kind of hit, I don't know if I would say like the nail on the head, but it's one of the most unique takes ever, because we were talking about this a couple years ago. It almost has like an I Am Legend aspect to it, because you're looking for this cure. You're trying to find out more about what you can do, because it's really the true plot is the bond between Nezuko and Tanjiro, and he really only is going through these things to save his sister, is his true intent, and people forget that. But at the same time, you're helping an even greater cause, which is how you can get lost in this world, which is how, you know, the greats have developed it, like Tolkien and Lord of the Rings. You always want to give him credit, and, you know, Harry Potter is, in my opinion, probably the greatest fantasy fiction of all time. But that's what's great about Demon Slayer, is it's the same idea concept, is it's developed a whole world here out of, and you can already see in just three episodes how immersive and in-depth this can go. What are your debates for the day, Jay Nelly?
I just have one debate, and it is something that's bothered me, and I'm wondering what the answer is to it. But if you remember in episode 2, with the first demon Tanjiro fought, the weak one that we were talking about, how he pinned it to the tree and he was going to take that small knife to it, and Uro Kodaki, when he first appeared, say, hey, that's not going to do the trick. And so he went and picked up a boulder and was going to smash the demon over the head repeatedly with the boulder. And even Uro Kodaki's like, oh man, this kid's indecisive. You know, he just pretty much make the decision and do it. We just learned that there's only two ways to kill a demon. We could only either cut its head off with a special sword, or sunlight will burn it to ash. So what was up with this whole, like, smashing it over the head with a rock to kill it, and why Uro Kodaki was disappointed that Tanjiro didn't take that action? Like, what, it wouldn't have done it any good anyways. You know, Uro Kodaki told him not to waste his time with a knife, so why the fuck would he waste his time with a boulder smashing it to bits?
That's a great question, because either it's a plot hole, which then there's another plot hole that comes up later based on what you mentioned, but it makes me think that Uro Kodaki doesn't know it all. Or you could make...
Well, let me argue that point right there, because Uro Kodaki is the one that narrated the entire part of him being like, there's only two ways to kill. So, like, like, he's the one that, I guess, in, if he is wrong, and maybe he's wrong in saying that there is only those two ways and he doesn't know the other ways, I guess. But if he just contradicted himself, regardless. Regardless if there are more ways to kill a demon than the two he mentioned, he absolutely contradicted himself, because he was the one narrating about the Demon Slayer core and how those were the two ways to kill demons, but he encouraged Tanjiro to smash its head to bits with a rock. So at the very least, he contradicted himself, whether he knows it or not.
Yeah, my thoughts, though, towards this, the way I kind of took it, which is a really in-depth analysis to even think of this. Most people would just think, oh, maybe like you can actually smash a demon's head in with a rock. I was thinking more of, he was trying to see if Tanjiro would stop contradicting himself and stop taking the emotional game out of it. And I don't think he thought it would kill that demon. I think Uro Kodaki would have probably taken out his sword and let him be, it was a hatchet, it would have been pinned to the tree anyways. Which kind of, you know, we'll learn more and more later on, but I don't think that exact demon would have been much of a threat with his head crushed. But I think probably what would have happened is he was trying to see if Tanjiro would have actually taken the initiative to crush it as much as he could, which we've seen in the, in kind of, well, we haven't really seen anything like it yet, but maybe, you know, beat it to a pulp, beat it to the point it can't do anything, right? And it just be there and take the emotion out of it and, like, see if he could get that anger in him to not hesitate. But he still saw that Tanjiro had that compassionate side to him, which is why he was debating whether or not he would even be a trainable person for what he's going to come into contact with the future, because it's a totally different level out there. So that's kind of the way I took it. But I think if he crushed its head, my opinion is it would just like stay crushed. And we see a lot of other things that can happen later on with things like that. So just a thought. What are your thoughts, Gianelli?
Yeah, he did mention in his monologue as well about the demons, that they're able to regenerate the body parts that are damaged. So even if he did crush it, he'd still be able to, at least at some point, even if it took him some time, probably be able to get his body back to what it was. So really the only thing that does make sense is something you touched on, is maybe it was just that Kodaki was testing Tanjiro and seeing if he had that killer instinct in him to do something so barbaric and have that aggression to where, like you mentioned, took the emotion out of it and just did whatever it takes to get the job done, even though maybe he knew in the back of his head it wouldn't actually kill the demon. He just wanted to see how far Tanjiro would go to let Urokodaki know that, okay, he's serious and he will do what's necessary when necessary. That's the only way, really, that it works. And then to your point about maybe Urokodaki doesn't know everything, there's other parts of things too that maybe contradict just the ways he mentioned with sunlight and with decapitating the demon with a special sword. So, you know, those are explainable if those are the explanations, but it's definitely something worth mentioning and notating, just because if you had mentioned if that's not the case, then yeah, that could be considered a pretty big plot hole for the entirety of the series. So that was just what I noticed on there, and I was like, man, we got to really talk about that, because if he really thought that, we're kind of in a world of shit just three episodes in, not even two episodes in. That's not a great way to start the full series on a plot hole like that. So I would tend to agree that maybe it was just a test, just to really determine exactly how prepared Tanjiro, what lengths Tanjiro was prepared to go to eradicate demons from the world. And you know, and obviously you saw his empathy and emotional capacity was stronger than his urge to kill, which definitely disturbed Urokodaki and made him think initially that Tanjiro is not going to make it, because if he can't bring himself to do this, this is one of the weakest demons. Like, what are you going to do when it's one of the fucking badass motherfuckers that you're going to have to deal with later on? So, yeah, no, it is explainable, but there's only really that way to explain it, that it was a test, and that, you know, for later on down the series road, that maybe Urokodaki doesn't have all the answers, even though he is kind of that, you know, mage-type character, that grandfather-esque protector, trainer, you know, sort of guy. So, yeah, that was just my debate there. I wanted to make sure we discussed it, but that's just the only one I had, man. Did you have any other thoughts on your end before we close up for the day?
Just before you close, I know we're kind of thinking of him as like an Albus Dumbledore, or like a Qui-Gon Jinn or something. He reminds me of like a Barristan Selmy. What do you think?
Barristan Selmy just played such a small role in the events of Game of Thrones that we saw on screen. Like, yeah, over the history of A Song of Ice and Fire, like leading up into what we saw when Robert Baratheon took over as king. You know, he had a really major role, and people considered him the greatest knight in all the Seven Kingdoms. But from what we actually saw, he didn't really do a whole lot. He kind of mentored Dany after his fighting prime was over. So I don't know if that comparison to Barristan Selmy is as, you know, I don't know if it's a strong comparison. I could see where it came from, of someone who at one point in time was considered a badass and could really, you know, go toe-to-toe with the best of the best, and now he's kind of taken a backseat in more of an advisory capacity. So I could see it in that, but I just don't know. I feel like Urokodaki is going to be more important towards the end of the series, whenever it does come to an end. I don't know if they're going to have 6 or 7 seasons, whatever it might be. I think he's going to play a very high-functional role towards, I mean, I'm not say high functional as if he's going to be the spotlight or the main character, or it's going to follow him or anything like that. But I think it's going to be a little bit more than Barrison's last stand against the Sons of the Harpy. Like, it's not the worst comparison. I just don't know if it's like the best comparison.
Yeah, maybe that's playing him down a little bit after he just took 2 fucking years to train this guy. Just to put this in your head for all our followers out there, and I know a lot of y'all watch this series, but think about it this way. like 2 years. That's the time Harry took from Sorcerer's Stone to Prisoner of Azkaban. Like, think about that. And Tondra was on a mountain the entire time. Like, holy shit. Like, he probably got cold up there at some point. Imagine, man. You know, no indoor plumbing. For sure. So, but yeah, with that, man, I'll let you close this out, Jay Nelly.
Yeah, sounds like a plan. So if this is your first time tuning in and listening, we really hope you enjoy what you heard and decide to stick around. If you have been with us since the very beginning, thank you for continuously being the shields that guard the realms of fantasy. In terms of where you can find us online, we're on all the social sites. You can find us on Instagram at Official Ridiculous Patronus. You can find us on TikTok at Ridiculous Patronus. We've got backup Instagram at @fact_or_fantasy. A backup TikTok at @fact_or_fantasy. We have a Facebook fan page, Chase and Josh Factor Fantasy. We're on YouTube, Ridiculous Patronus. We are on Twitter, RP Factor Fantasy, Snapchat, RP Factor Fantasy. And we do have our own website, ridiculouspatronus.blogspot.com as well. So please click like, subscribe, leave written reviews, comment. All the audience engagement is super beneficial to us here on the show. So please keep that up. Leave those star ratings on Spotify as well. And in terms of where you can find us, on like in terms of the podcast, like on those platforms, we are wherever you get your podcast. So if you're an Android user, we're on Google Play. If you're an iPhone user, we're on Apple Podcasts. We're on Spotify, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, Audible, Stitcher, Acast, our host site Podbean. Again, wherever you get your podcast, Chase and Josh Factor Fantasy are there. But we are out for the day because this has been another ridiculous production.
Chase and Josh
Factor Fantasy
signing off.